Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
From the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network for movie talk, this is Historic Hollywood, spotlighting the most influential and founding members of Hollywood.
The 1920s radio voice always makes me giggle a little bit. Hello, Internet. Welcome to another edition of Historic Hollywood, a celebration of the cinema of yesteryear and the people who made it. Follow the network all over the place, youtube.com/popcorntalknetwork. All over social media, the handle is @ThePopcornTalk. I am Lex Michael. I'm also all over the social media things. My handle is @TheLexMichael, and I am here with...
Byron Thompson.
Carrie Bible.
So today we are talking about film noir, and there is such a crazy amount to unpack here that we have decided for the second time to split this conversation into two parts. Now, I wanted to start the conversation before we dig too much into individual movies, individual stylistics. I wanted to open the discussion first and foremost by asking, when we talk about film noir, what are we talking about? What is a film noir? What are some of the characteristics that, to either of you, define what film noir is?
Well, I think that's a great question, Lex, because a lot of people think that noir has to have flashbacks in it.
Sure.
And a lot of people think that it has to be black and white.
Right.
Which, clearly, neither one of those are correct.
Sure.
I feel more so now that film noir is much more a component of modern films, even though I don't think necessarily people think of modern films as being film noir, which I know we'll jump to that obviously in the second episode.
Yes.
But I would love for Carrie, since she is a attending member of the Film Noir Festival every year, to try to give us a better idea of how they kind of define it.
Again, it's complicated. I won't use the word Jim Zellroy used for this, but he always says film noir is basically you're effed, you're screwed. Because... Okay. And things are conspiring against you left and right. Eddie Moeller of the Film Noir Foundation, who's an amazing historian and guy, he basically has described it to me as the dissolution of the American dream.
Okay.
You know, you come back from World War II and sort of the American dream that you'd been longing to have sort of falls apart. And film noir is sort of a lot of, about that, and about that cynicism, about that darkness. It doesn't always have to take place in an urban setting either. There's a lot of noirs that take place in all sorts of settings, but it's about a lot. It's so hard to describe again because there's so many things, but greed and corruption and lust and larceny and just one thing after another turning a wrong corner and
sure.
going downhill.
Would it be correct in saying that the French critics are what kind of coined that phrase when they started seeing those American films that had so much despair in them?
Yeah,
because you said after World War II, that's when the whole thing kind of...
really took off. It was beginning long before World War II.
Sure.
But yeah, I think the French are always so far ahead of the game and all the rest of us, especially when it comes to film. And yeah, I mean, they never called it film noir at that time. That label would definitely come later.
I believe it was actually 1946. The French critic Nino Frank first coined the term film noir, which means black film. And I do think it's interesting that noir as a, let's not even say a genre, let's say more a collection of styles, maybe, really coalesced, came to fruition in America, but it did take a handful of years and the French to identify it for us. And so, Carrie, you were talking a little bit about, you know, there are certain elements that are considered to be definitive or quintessentially noir, but it is interesting, so many titles that are sometimes referred to as noir films, there is a lot of debate about
yeah.
them, because there is such a wide amount of variance in what elements are constant noir and which ones aren't. I mean, almost any trope, noir trope, that you can point to as being that, you know, there's just as many examples that fit somewhere in the noir genre that don't incorporate some of those elements. So, for example, like the traditional noir protagonist in most people's minds, or I know for me personally, when I think film noir protagonist, I think of, you know, Humphrey Bogart as the private investigator in the trench coat and the fedora. And that's certainly one type, but even if that's the first image that comes to mind when somebody thinks of a film noir protagonist, that was actually, if I'm not mistaken, a fairly rare, there weren't that many of those, it was a fairly rare example, the put upon private eye.
I don't know that it was a rare example. I really couldn't, I don't know. I mean, that's something you definitely see.
It's
but,
a literary example, I think. Like, you were talking about the literature being the origin. I think that came more from that than...
Well, one thing I think is really cool about the Film Noir Festival, which, yeah, I religiously attend every year, Alan Rohde and Eddie Muller program it. And it would honestly be easy to just program the same films every year, Postman and Mildred Pierce and so forth. But they really mine the vaults to find really obscure titles, hidden gems that people haven't really seen and aren't really talking about and should be. And... another thing is they kind of pushed the boundaries of what people normally consider noir. They did one sure. night called Swamp Noir, and they were all noir stories, but they take place in a swamp instead of a big city, or they've done Victorian noir, or they kind of take the noir concept and really push it far beyond, you know, what a lot of people consider the bounds. But I think it's so great they do that, though, because it really kind of shows you just how vast that influence was and how many different kind of films it permeated.
Sure. Now, I do, Byron just mentioned the literary aspect where that, for example, the private eye protagonist in noir originated. I did want to talk a bit, especially before we get into what is considered to be the classic era of film noir in the 40s and 50s, I did want to talk a bit about the origins of film noir. And it comes from a number of different schools of filmmaking. I think if you follow it the furthest back, the cinematic influence can be traced pretty directly to German Expressionism, which was a movement that started in the 1910s and the 1920s. And you see in the late 20s, into the early 30s, directors like Fritz Lang or Robert Vena with Cabinet of Dr. Caligari were implementing this new and very exaggerated, heightened, intense style.
Yeah, to me, it all begins with the M.
Yes.
I mean, I know you were mentioning Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is a wonderful film, but with the noir aspect, especially from what Carrie was saying with me, everything starts with M because all these components we're talking about that move around in all kinds of genres, everything's an M. That is basically what defines noir, even though clearly, if somebody were to tell you what the story was, nobody would be saying, oh, that's obviously a noir. It doesn't fit. But the movie is, clearly.
Well, it's, yeah, I think the plot is noir-ish. You've got...
it's dark.
You've got a protagonist, and this is whether your protagonist is a private investigator or a police officer or a criminal, whoever it is. Noir stories almost invariably deal with people who are not of the highest, most stringent moral character, let's say. I think Peter Lorre's character in M certainly fits that to a T. And then you also have in that film, you have, like you say, the stylistics of German Expressionism that Fritz Lang brought to it. And that was a movie he made, I believe it was 1931. And he made that movie and it was released, I believe, shortly before he came to America. And around that time, there were a combination of factors that drove a lot of these German Expressionists and people coming out of that school of filmmaking towards Hollywood. Partially it was there's opportunities here. And part of it was obviously at that point the Nazis were coming to power. And
sure.
That was the main reason.
I think anybody who could see the writing on the wall went, you know, I'm going to go make my movies elsewhere. But you got a handful of guys. You got directors like Fritz Lang, Michael Curtiz, Robert Siodmak, who all came to America and started...
Billy Wilder.
Yes, Billy Wilder is a perfect example of filmmakers who came over at that time from Germany and started bringing that sensibility to Hollywood. And at the same time, you've got the American gangster movie was fairly popular. And what I thought was interesting is that you see noir evolve a little bit out of what happened when the American gangster movie met the German Expressionist sensibilities.
I do want to mention one thing, though. It's on DVD. There's a Joseph von Sternberg box set, I believe, from Criterion. Docks of New York and Underworld are fantastic.
Underworld is amazing.
Gangster.
One of the best films ever.
Silent movies. And they really have absolutely gorgeous cinematography and really a tremendous amount of kind of pre-noir if you get a chance to see those.
Yeah, and it is like a – it's interesting to me. You mentioned gangster movies, and I was talking a minute ago about gangster movies as well. It's interesting to me how so many very popular gangster movies, movies like, you know, like Little Caesar, Public Enemy, Scarface, which is the Hawks movie, which we talked about on our very first episode.
Sure.
Angels with Dirty Faces, which is directed by Curtiz himself. A lot of these movies are not, strictly speaking, noir in the strictest sense, but these movies have a lot in common, both in their choice of protagonist or type of protagonist, as well as structurally where their journey takes them, the ups and then their eventual downfall, is something that you see carried over into noir a lot.
Right, and because you got to brought up the gangster thing, I wanted to mention one of my favorites is also another Fritz Lang film, an American film, The Big Heat.
Yes.
Which brings a lot of those gangster things in, but unlike unlike the great Scarface or even Little Caesar, where the gangsters were such a component of the city, this is almost like our life. It's the gangsters are clearly intermixed with our lives.
Sure.
Which makes the noir thing a little different than, it's kind of like what Carrie said, it's very hard to define. It's definitely noir, but by the same token, it could have been a movie you go see with your family. It just turns out that it's got a little bit of a darker belly, perhaps.
Right.
And I think that's the best part about those type of movies is the surprise.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting, too, that you see there are certain types of noir stories that I think it is tough because so many of these movies do defy categorization under one very tight umbrella. But it's interesting. You see the private eye stories that came out of the literary works in the 1920s with the pulp detective stories.
Absolutely.
And that's actually a good place to jump in. You've got your filmic origins, but you've also got your literary origins, and the primary literary influence for these stories were these detective stories that were published in these pulp magazines like Black Mask, for example, by authors like Dashiell Hammett, James M. Cain, Raymond Chandler were a lot of the big ones.
Jim Thompson.
And a lot of these authors, not only were many of their works directly adapted into some of the most noteworthy or at least most well-known noir movies of all time. Chandler himself, for example, would go on to write a handful of screenplays as well. If I'm not mistaken, he did write a screenplay for Double Indemnity. I believe he also wrote The Blue Dahlia. I believe he wrote Strangers on a Train as well. But it's that, and that's where you get that. When you picture, like I did for the longest time, exclusively picture the Humphrey Bogart in, say, Maltese Falcon. Maltese Falcon's a Dashiell Hammett story. I mean, that was taken directly from these stories, this school of writing that then you marry with what was happening stylistically with the German expressionists coming over and tweaking the gangster style, and you get something like The Maltese Falcon, which is one of the, I would say, certainly not first, but one of the earlier real big examples that I think most people are aware of.
Well, when we were talking about the definition of noir, one of the things, especially since you said Maltese Falcon, and I hope Carrie will agree with me, is one of the things that really defines noir is they never end well.
No.
And in Hollywood, especially because of what we've already talked about on this show about the Hays Code and all these different things, having not a good ending was not really the hot thing, but it suddenly became in vogue. It became something different. And noirs were something, like I'm sure Carrie can say more because she goes to the festival, that became a big component where they made a lot of those films specifically, and that was okay. It was okay to have it. It's almost like if you define it a certain way and it's successful, it's okay. But at the time, that was not really popular to have a movie where the heroin is going to go to jail. So that was not clearly the norm. I'm saying that's a key component of what we're talking about. The ending is not always the happy ending.
I do want to say, though, there are a few noirs I just thought of that actually do have happy endings, but it's definitely the exception. It's not always the case, but...
But, like, exactly, and I wanted to ask you, piggybacking, Byron, on what you just said, I think it's interesting, too, that that is the case, that you hadn't really seen so many movies being released where, yeah, things don't pan out. No, they don't ride off into the sunset at the end. In fact, usually they're dead. I'm wondering if you look at what is considered traditionally to be the quote-unquote golden age of film noir in the 40s and into the 50s, it really starts as the country, the United States, is coming out of World War II. And I'm wondering how much of that had an impact on the national psyche at the time. And maybe we were ready for something like that. I mean, clearly, we were ready for something like that as an audience that we hadn't been in the past. So I'm wondering if you see a direct connection there as well.
Well, I don't think anything's ever done in a vacuum. I think art is always a response to what's happening in the world. And there was a lot going on at that time. I mean, a lot of people were coming back from the war. You've got people coming back with post-traumatic stress syndrome. you've got women who enjoyed a measure of freedom and independence that they probably hadn't had before, working in jobs and, you know, having this independence. And all of a sudden, they're forced back into the kitchen. They're forced back into these sort of roles that many of them might have not ever wanted and wanted to reject. You had an extremely sexually repressed conservative sort of feeling that was sweeping the country. Had the House on Un-American Activities going on, and a lot of people horribly ruined by that. And just a lot of stuff is going on all over the country that's really got to be, you know, seeping into the psyche of these films, without question.
Well, and you brought up specifically, and I think I reacted visibly, and Byron, you reacted to my visible reaction, but you were talking about it for one of the first times, certainly, in the way that it was happening, the role of women was starting to expand. They were starting to get more involved, starting to take more ownership of themselves, or certainly to express that they had a desire to take more ownership of themselves. And I think it's interesting that this was happening at this time, because one of the biggest, most well-known film noir tropes is that of the femme fatale. And I think it's interesting, these movies, which were almost without exception written by men, directed by men, based on stories written by men.
There are a lot of women film noir writers, actually, though. There are some.
But I'm wondering, too, especially when you trace some of these stories back, these femme fatale characters, back to the works of fiction by these men at the time they were written, I'm wondering how much of the portrayal of women in some of these stories, because many of them are portrayed as very cold, very calculating, very nasty, dare I say, evil people. I'm wondering how much of that, in your perception, is a reflection of maybe male insecurities of the time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to say. It's hard to kind of sit here and armchair analyze what someone else would have been thinking.
Fair.
But what I do know is those movies yielded such great roles for women. I mean, women had kind of a ferociousness in noir that you almost never see crop up in any other genre. I mean, Detour alone is just absolutely phenomenal female performance that is unrelentingly furious. And I don't know if the word empowered is the right word, but she takes no prisoners, period, end of story.
Sure.
So,
yeah. I think one of the most iconic femme fatales in all of film noir-dom would be Barbara Stanwyck in Double Indemnity.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I can only speak for myself personally, but when I think femme fatale, that's the figure that pops into my head. This role that she played so intensely and so perfectly that the character and the way she played the character almost became an archetype in and of itself.
Well, one thing I always think of in noir is the fact that they don't do today star entrances. Like, the first time you see a star in a movie, that's an impactful moment. That's your first impression of them in that film. And in Double Indemnity, you see an ankle bracelet.
Yeah.
You see a leg. You see a woman wrapped in a towel, i.e. naked underneath. So that's like the first thing you see of her in that movie, and that sticks with you. That's a huge impression right there.
Yeah.
Talking about entrances, what did you think of the entrance of what we were talking about before taping in Gun Crazy? Because that's kind of a different approach.
Oh, yeah.
The guys
are
at the fair or whatever, and basically they go to the shooting
gallery, yeah.
But I think that's kind of unexpected. I thought that was a nice surprise.
Yeah, it was a great surprise. Another one would be Rita Hayworth and Gilda. The first time you see her, you see that hair fly up and that face come up, and you just think, he doesn't stand a chance.
Yeah.
This doesn't, you know, this is great. I mean, they don't do that. Or the first time you see Lana Turner and Postman. That thing, I forget what it is, rolls on the floor and at her feet. And guess what? They pan up those beautiful high heels and those long legs and that white little two-piece outfit. And, yeah, they don't do entrances like that in modern movies, for sure.
I like specifically what you said about Rita Hayworth's entrance, where you think this guy does not stand a chance. And I think that's, again, that's fairly consistent regardless of who your protagonist in a noir motion picture is. It's somebody, if not out of their element, certainly about to be consumed by the element they're in. It was actually when I was looking into noir influences, there were a couple that I figured, you know, that stood out to me before I even started. I knew German Expressionism was a factor. I knew Italian Neorealism was a factor. But I was pointed to French Poetic Realism, which I will be the first to admit, haven't studied extensively. But referring to French Poetic Realism as an important developmental touchstone for noir because it has this focus on doomed heroes and this romantic, fatalistic attitude that you see over and over again. Because the world in noir movies typically is one that is not hopeful. It's not, it's a very, most of these movies have a very pessimistic worldview, I would say. And I think everybody you meet is corrupt to one extent or another. So I thought it was interesting that I was pointed towards French poetic realism because I see now the through line in a way that I hadn't quite seen before. And the other important filmic point of origin, as I mentioned, is Italian neorealism, which you really started to see influence noir, I think, more towards the mid to late 40s. Mm-hmm. But Italian neorealism, I mean, some of the traits that define that school of filmmaking would be quasi-documentary style, a lot of actual locations as opposed to shooting in studios.
We didn't talk about that, but that's the biggest thing about noir is they wanted to not shoot anything on a set.
Right.
And like, just we were talking about some of the earlier noir, like M even, the whole idea is they had this documentary style of making the film, which I think really comes off incredibly well, because then when you're watching something like Postman, Always Drinks Twice or something, you're not feeling like we're on a set somewhere. They actually shot in real locations. That's a huge benefit, I think.
One of the things I love about noir is I'm fascinated by locations. And a lot of them, I saw a really, really great one at the Noir Fest a while back called A Chicago Calling. And Dan Duryea is the star. And the entire film takes place in Bunker Hill. That pretty much, for the most part, doesn't exist anymore in Los Angeles. So you're kind of shy of a time machine. This is your view into what it looked like to live on Bunker Hill at that time.
Yeah, I think the first movie that really opened my eyes to this influence, the Italian neorealist influence, specifically where noir is concerned, because it's a movie that gets thrown into the noir conversation pretty frequently, is Jules Dassin's The Naked City in 48. And like I said, you start to see that semi-documentary style appear more and more in movies of this type, I think, the further we get into the 40s. But earlier than that, even, there's one movie that, Byron, we talked about before we got on mic, and it's the movie that I think, of the movies that are not traditionally included in these conversations about what is, strictly speaking, film noir, it is probably the movie that has had the single greatest influence on the genre, while not directly being a part of it. Byron, do you want to talk a little bit about that movie?
Are we talking about Citizen Kane?
We are, in fact, talking about Orson Welles' Citizen Kane.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I never once even thought of Kane as being a noir until much, much later as an adult. And then suddenly someone had written an essay about it, and it made perfect sense. Everything that any filmmaker, even all the ones that Carrie and I were talking about, like Ida Lupino and all these, you know, Fritz Lang and everybody, everything they have actually comes from Kane. And that sounds odd because Kane certainly is not a noir film, but Greg Tolan, because of the way that he saw film and the opportunity to work with somebody that had no restrictions, they, to me, as far as I'm concerned, created what film is. And in the process, created every stylistic that is in noir, even though it may not be used in a noir fashion. But a great example to me would be his wife, the opera singer, who of course is not really an opera singer.
Right.
There's a sequence that's shot like at a fireplace at the castle, the Hearst Castle type, or the Xanadu.
Xanadu.
And all these things are so dark with the deep focus. It's clearly a noir sequence, but yet it could be a soap opera.
Sure.
The way Welles plays it. But all of that stuff had such a tremendous influence. When I saw all these films later, it seems like there's a, as you said about the French literary throughway, it's the same thing. Every film that you can ever see that's noir, you can easily see that it's influenced right off of Kane, in terms of stylistics at least, not necessarily in either writing or anything.
Yeah, it's exactly what you're saying, and I think some of what he was doing visually certainly had a lot more in common with what the German Expressionists were doing than what was happening in contemporary Hollywood at the time.
That was the key to everything, absolutely, for sure.
On top of which, you start to see things like the voiceover structure, the bending of the timeline, for example, like the using flashbacks heavily. A lot of that stuff is stuff that you're going to start seeing in American noir movies over and over and over and over and over again. And Welles himself would go on to make three pretty seminal noir movies over the course of his career.
Without even really even making any effort. It was almost as if like he set the tone, at least in America, because I know we're talking about a global sensation here, obviously.
Right. So Citizen Kane happens, and that happens in, it was 41, I believe.
41, correct.
41, and this movement had already started to evolve. This was already starting to happen in the late 30s, and again, some of the gangster movies that we saw in the late 30s evoked a lot of the same, what do you call it, same characteristics.
The themes, all that stuff was there.
And then, you know, you get your German immigrant filmmakers who start to apply their brand of filmmaking to that style, and it starts to bleed into the rest of what a lot of these filmmakers are doing. And I think, like I was saying before, like what we were talking about, just the time was right. I think the time was right in the national consciousness for something like this. And it's – I mean, look, it's called black film for a reason. These stories are dark. They're about doomed people. They're about not necessarily the nicest or most well-intentioned people. There's murder is usually a key prominent plot point. But also you start to see American filmmakers employing some of these very expressionistic scenic and design choices, even if it's something like the lighting. You start to see the Venetian blind lighting, for example, around this time. Things that make the world feel more imposing, more confined, more
and
punishing.
Trapped, for sure.
And trapped,
that's
is the perfect
that's
word.
That's the entire idea, because I know we haven't spoken about it, but I know Carrie wanted to speak a little bit about it. It's a film called... I hope I get the title right. Is it In a Lonely Place?
Oh my gosh, some of my all-time favorites.
I just totally feel it, since we're talking specifically about the stylistics. To me, that's the epitome of noir. I think that's such a wonderful movie. And I know you wanted to speak about it a little bit, so...
That movie breaks my heart so...
Great film.
So badly. Nicholas Ray,
yes.
Of course. You know, if people say Bogart was great in Casablanca and Maltese Falcon, I agree. But I honestly think that In a Lonely Place is his finest moment in
Agreed.
Film. Finest film
absolutely.
Ever.
Absolutely. The top. That's as good as it gets.
Never been better than that. It's
what,
a film,
what a range.
Yeah,
I mean, the person he plays is, especially in a noir sense, it's all over the map.
Yeah, he's a screenwriter, and he falls in love with a woman who lives in his apartment complex. And they begin a relationship, but it's doomed by Bogart's career problems, by his extremely violent temper.
There's
innuendo,
everything
rumors
against them,
and everything.
Noir,
yeah.
And also, too, I noticed that even if you have a character that doesn't have bad intentions, regardless, they wind up suffering very badly in the end, whether they want to or not. That's part of the deal.
The protagonist will usually, if not be malicious in intent, will usually find himself in a situation, him or herself, but often himself, in a situation that he didn't necessarily create but ends up exacerbating.
Which is exactly what happens in that film.
Right.
From what, I mean, it couldn't have been said any better. It's like this film starts almost in a soap opera type way, and it is such a wonderful film, but clearly every circumstance that he gets into, he's trapped, and he certainly didn't create those circumstances.
Well,
he's clearly a victim almost.
So, I mean, he has a really violent temper. He doesn't handle things well. He is very explosive, and he slowly casts a lot of doubts in Gloria Graham's character's mind, and I think her name is Laurel, in that movie, because she slowly starts to think, maybe he could have committed this murder, maybe this is possible.
Sure.
And it's just, it's so literate, too. I've seen this film so many times, and sometimes I've put it on, and I'll work in the next room, and you can just listen to the dialogue in this film like a radio show. You really can. It's absolutely beautiful.
Well, I love his friends.
Oh, yeah.
When they
go
over and he tries to, I guess, the choking or whatever, it's just so amazing because the line's blurred. At a certain point in time, you yourself feel kind of like the Gloria Graham, like, I don't even really know who this person is. It's
sure.
that good of a movie.
Yeah, it really is. And again, Gloria Graham, she's a good character. She doesn't have a bad heart. She's not a bad woman, but she winds up suffering very, very badly in this film. And I think Eddie Muller also said film noir is also suffering with style. So that
sure.
would also make a lot of sense. But it's just such a powerful film.
Oh, great film.
If you ever get the chance to see it on a big screen again, I always say that like every episode, but that's okay because it's true.
It's absolutely true.
It's a different experience.
I saw that on the big screen. It's amazing.
Yeah. So we are, when we're talking about movies like that, we're talking about movies that were released in what is, as mentioned earlier, traditionally considered to be the quote-unquote golden age of film noir. And it's after this style had evolved and after Welles with Citizen Kane had shown people, not only does this works really, really well, we started to see a lot of these movies. And that's why I think it becomes a little bit difficult sometimes to differentiate what is absolutely considered film noir and what is not, because as we've been talking about, there are so many – there are things that we see over and over again, but there are enough stylistic variances that there have been debates among film critics forever about which films necessarily fit the mold and which ones do not. I thought it was interesting that by – there was a couple of different polls that were taken, but by the 80s into the 90s, film historians and critics had come to agree on a canon of give or take 20 or so in either direction about 300 movies that were released from about 1940 to 1958. So now that we're into this era where all of these big noir movies that people are familiar with were released, and there are so very many of them, I just want to completely open this conversation up. But I think maybe one way I'd like to do that is we've brought up directly or indirectly Humphrey Bogart a number of times, and I think for a lot of people he is, if not the, certainly one of the quintessential film noir actors. So maybe to start with, who to you guys are some of the quintessential film noir actors and actresses?
I'd say Joan Crawford. Basically, Mildred Pierce completely injected whole new life into her career. Also finally won her the Academy Award for Best Actress. And she's fantastic in that movie, as is Anne Blythe, directed by Michael Curtiz. I think it's one of the seminal film noirs, actually, and it's really, really excellent. And Joan, given her hard scramble roots and her sort of relentless, ruthless personality, she's just the perfect film noir heroine.
Sure.
You know, she's got that hard-boiled sort of shell. And she's also wonderful. She did so many noirs. I mean, we could do a whole thing just on the noirs of Joan Crawford. But she also did another great one called The Damned Don't Cry. That's also really, really good in the later 50s.
What is that? I will fully admit to never having seen that particular film. So could you tell me a little bit about it?
Oh, yeah. Damn, Don't Cry. It's said to have been based loosely on Virginia Hill, the mistress of mobster Bugsy Siegel.
Okay.
But she kind of starts out like vulnerable in the beginning of the movie. And then, again, just due to circumstances and due to things, becomes extremely hard-boiled. And it's just kind of really fascinating to watch that evolution of how she goes from one extreme to the other within the confines of this film.
Sure.
And it's a really good movie.
Yeah.
I think it was directed by Vincent Sherman, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Byron, what are the first couple that come to mind? Because there are a lot of them.
Well, there's too many to name. But
sure.
My favorite is Sterling Hayden.
Sterling Hayden.
And the reason why isn't because of the great Asphalt Jungle, which we already spoke about on this show, but it's Kubrick's The Killing.
Yes, see, okay.
Because The Killing, which is based on a Jim Thompson story called Clean Break.
Yes.
The Killing, and I'm not trying to be funny about the fact that we talked about all these different ideas for noir. The Killing is a definition of all of those, as you put it, tropes. It's got the flashbacks, it's got the flash forwards, it's got this multi-layered kind of almost, if you're not really paying attention, you're going to miss something plot.
Right.
And yet Hayden, just like in Asphalt, he's just a powerhouse in the film. And I feel that he's the quintessential, to me, noir guy.
He's also one of the actors that I think of specifically as related to movies like Asphalt Jungle and The Killing, which to me, and I brought this up when we talked about Asphalt Jungle, I believe it was on our Marilyn Monroe episode. There is a type of noir film that it's a heist. I mean, it's about criminals pulling off a heist. And there are certain heist movies in the noir fashion that are structured. There are variances certainly in the details of their structure, but that are structured more or less, you take a step back, big picture, very, very similarly as far as group of criminals gets together, plans the heist. The heist is the centerpiece of the movie. And then they all, by the end of the movie, without going into specific spoilers, as in most noirs, get their comeuppance. And it's movies like Asphalt Jungle, which I think structurally is very similar in that sense to The Killing. The other one that I believe I brought up when we talked about Asphalt Jungle was Jules Dassin's Rafifi, which was a movie
right.
that he made very much in the same mold, but he made it after, let's call it political troubles, drove him to go hang out in France for a little bit.
Right, and you talk about these heist films, about the influence. There's one that was a huge influence on Scorsese. It's a film called Five Against the House with Brian Keith, which is also clearly a noir in a sense, but a film that's clearly, in your words, a heist film, but they're trying to rob a casino.
Yes.
I mean, which is a great idea because nobody had ever really done it at that time, but it's a little seen film. I think it's been a part of the festival that Carrie's gone to a couple times, but it had a huge influence on Scorsese because of its simplicity. Because like you said, there's a lot of those films that have that heist thing. It doesn't really mean anything if you're not doing something with it.
Right. So Sterling Hayden is one. Who would be Sterling Hayden is tops for you. So who would, who's hanging on to Sterling Hayden's coat, riding behind him?
I have to say, even though it's probably odd because he hasn't made too many, I have to go with Glenn Ford.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, Glenn Ford, but why? Sell me Glenn Ford like I've never thought about Glenn Ford before, and you want to make this Glenn Ford sale to me, a plebeian.
Well, there's a couple of movies, two to be specific, that I just absolutely believe everything he does in them. One, of course, is The Great Gilda, and the other is The Big Heat with he plays this cop that actually has to go up against Lee Marvin.
He's great in Human Desire, too.
Oh, yeah, Human Desire. Yeah. I mean, to me, it's endless, but those are the two keys for me, and the only reason why I would sell them to you in the best way is that you have to see him. You believe him. And to me, Glenn Ford, unlike the Sterling Hayden character, is, no disrespect, he might be a little bit more like me. He's a little more stable. Hayden's never stable. Hayden's like a loose cannon in any movie. He's just off the rails. But Ford seems to be like that guy that could be your neighbor.
Sure.
He's going to be the good guy. And you kind of want him to benefit. You want him to kind of overcome these obstacles. And in all of his movies, he's got obstacles left and right.
Sure.
He's my favorite.
Okay. Glenn Ford. Yeah. Okay. For me, because that was my way in, I always go back to Bogart. But then actors I'm a big fan of Edward G. Robinson, who pops up in either leading or supporting roles in a lot of these movies.
Fantastic.
I'm a huge fan of Edward G. Robinson. I'm actually more than even the leading men in these movies. I tend to really fixate on the actors who play these supporting character parts. They're almost always villainous characters, but actors like Peter Lorre, who was the lead in M and would show up in supporting roles in Maltese Falcon, in Casablanca, Sydney Greenstreet. Same deal.
Oh, crazy. Crazy good.
Those are the actors that I tend to focus on. And I also think, too, noir was a perfect home for actors like that, who certainly were very, very capable, but they had these faces, these personas, these images.
They were conventionally handsome guys. They weren't Tyrone Power.
Exactly. And it lent itself so much to figures populating these very dark and very seedy worlds that were the focus of films noir. So those are some of the actors that you really like. What about noir directors? Because there are certain filmmakers that are more associated than others with the genre. There are certain filmmakers that dabbled in it. There are certain filmmakers whose works are debated heatedly about whether or not they should be included in what is the quote-unquote official noir canon. So where does that conversation kick off for you guys?
Well, I always think that a good film noir director is a director who doesn't only direct noirs.
Sure.
I mean, I don't feel that you can really have somebody who's made something worth something unless they've got some type of balance. We talked briefly about The Killing from Kubrick.
Yes.
But with me, my favorite noir director, he probably has only got maybe three to his credit, is Samuel Fuller.
Samuel Fuller.
Absolutely. The pickup on South Street, I think, is as good as it gets. Naked Kiss, just completely. I just don't think it ever gets better than that. But by the same token, you flip over to Wilder and you've got Sunset Boulevard. You know, you've got clearly Double Indemnity. There's no shortage. But yeah, to me, that's my favorite.
This didn't come up in our Wilder discussion, but one movie I love that he did, Ace in the Hole.
Yes.
Great film.
God, that's such a good movie. Oh, my gosh.
Not a noir, but a fantastic film.
I think it kind of be.
It shares a lot of traits.
It shares a lot of DNA. A lot of the same threads.
And that's a perfect example of why sometimes noir can be very hard to definitively pick out, because it does share so many traits in common with what we expect from a noir movie, but it doesn't quite behave like one. It's more directly a satire of the media than a traditional noir story, but many of the structural points are shared. Certainly the fact that the character finds himself in a situation that he didn't create but exacerbates and receives for the sake of this conversation, a non-specific comeuppance at the end, certainly. And I also think Lost Weekend is a movie that a lot of people leave out of the conversation now, but I also think it shares many, many traits in common with the noir movies as influenced more by Italian neorealism. That was a title that I saw come up a lot as far as noir movies, quote-unquote, noir movies created through that prism. I feel like we also have to mention John Huston.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Not just for Asphalt Jungle, but for a number of his other contributions. And I think more than anybody else, It was Houston's movies. It was casting Bogart as the Sam Spade character that certainly created that indelible image that I identify most closely with noirs.
And then Hawks takes it further with The Big Sleep, obviously.
The Big Sleep. And I love, too, that that was based on a Chandler novel, and that was the Philip Marlowe character.
And wasn't Faulkner one of the co-authors on the screenplay?
If I'm not mistaken, like yeah, that? I think so.
It's crazy the way that that was at that time.
Well, and I love, too, that it's Big Sleep is a perfect example of how, in most cases, I think, now you'll have this labyrinthine plot in many noir stories, but they tend to prioritize mood, characterization, even their environment, all above plot. And I think a perfect example is that story where the plot of The Big Sleep is famously so complicated that there's that story where they had to ask Raymond Chandler at one point. There's a driver character in the movie, a supporting character, and he turns up dead at some point in the narrative. It's entirely unclear which one of these duplicitous, seedy characters may have killed the driver. And so they go and ask Raymond Chandler, who wrote the novel that is the source material, and his answer is more or less, I don't know.
I have no idea.
Yeah, just whoever. You know, so Houston is one, and then Hawks, obviously, for Big Sleep. Fritz Lang would come to America, after doing so many iconic German expressionist works that would influence the entire movement, and he himself would direct a number of noir movies. He did The Big Heat, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
And he also did Clash by Night, which we've talked about.
Which has noir elements, like the DNA that we're talking about. It's all
exactly
there.
All of those elements are there. There's a lot of discussion about a number of Alfred Hitchcock's movies. Now, some of them, I think, certainly fit.
I think you mentioned the one that's key to the whole discussion, which is Strangers.
Strangers on a train.
Not just necessarily because of the author, but because he seemed to have this idea, and I think Carrie would even agree with me. He seemed to love to please the audience. That one's not so much of an audience pleaser.
Sure.
But the theme and the tone is obviously noir. It's a great film.
Yeah, and there are a number of his movies that I think most people agree fall into that category. But then there are some, for example, there's a debate that still exists in certain circles over movies like Vertigo. Even though Vertigo doesn't necessarily feel, as you're watching it, like a noir movie, it still shares a lot of those traits in common. You've got your... It's another example of a protagonist that doesn't create the bad situation he's in, but certainly exacerbates it through some of the decisions he makes. You've got
he's in love.
He's, of course. Who can blame him?
He's following his heart.
But you've also got your duplicitous femme fatale character. You've got an ending where, again, I won't go into specifics because Vertigo's so good. Everybody go watch Vertigo right now. Like, why? When you're done listening to us, don't stop now. But when we're done talking,
go
find Vertigo. Maybe it's on Netflix. If it's not, I'm sure you can get it on disc. It's not very expensive. But the end of that movie, again, it's not like they get to ride off into the sunset together.
That's the best thing about noir.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm trying to think, like, who else specifically can we talk about? I mean, there's Wilder, there's Long. We talked about William Castle at length last week. He made a couple of movies in the Whistler series around this time, which are considered
Aldrich, which he had brought up, Joan Crawford, she'd done the whatever happened to Baby Jane. I mean, these are, even though they're very modern, they are pure noir.
Aldrich did direct one of my all-time favorite noirs, Kiss Me Deadly.
Fantastic.
Gosh, that was so good.
Well, what makes Kiss Me Deadly one of your favorite film noirs of all time?
Oh, it's so hard to, again, I don't know why I have trouble articulating why I love this stuff so much, but it's just so mysterious, it's so witty, it's so intelligent, it's so immensely watchable. There's something about it that's really intoxicating.
Didn't Aldrich also do the Big Knife?
I can't remember, to be honest.
That sounds right. Well, that's also another one of my favorites that has all the DNA, so to speak. Jack Palance, never better.
Yeah, Jack Palance is a perfect example of an actor, too, who just his appearance, he seems designed as if he was intentionally sculpted at birth to play heavies in movies like this.
And he's kind of the hero in that movie. It's kind of odd.
Well, too, but like him and Bogart's the same way, where you look at his face and this is not, he's not, like Carrie was saying before, he's not the traditional Hollywood leading man type of the era, but the characters that they played didn't call for that. You need somebody who wears their life experience on their face.
Robert Mitchum.
Mitchum.
Oh, that's the one right there.
Out of the past.
Out of the, for sure.
With Jacques Tourneur, I think that's one of the best.
Angel Face.
Yeah.
That's a great one.
Well, and even another movie that is sometimes included in the conversation and sometimes not is Night of the Hunter.
Some people, that's one of, oh my gosh. Yeah.
And some people consider that to be, and it has certain, it plays to me more like a strange, dark bedtime story.
Well, it's like a bad fairy tale.
Yeah, exactly. But it still shares so many, stylistically, the visual style of that movie as directed by Charles Laughton, I think
shares.
The only
film he ever directed.
Yeah, the only film, as good as it gets. It's really, really good. But that movie, too, is another one that is a lot of people are on the fence about. A debate exists. We're a little bit pressed for time. Now, thankfully, we are going to split this conversation into two episodes, so we are going to pick this up in our next episode. But before we put a pin in it for now, I just, are there any other movies really quickly? And you will, obviously, we'll have an opportunity in our next episode to delve in a little bit more. As we also move on, we talk a little bit about neo-noir. We're going to talk a little bit about other countries that are employing, and filmmakers in other countries that are employing some of these noir stylistics at the time. And we can talk about filmmakers like Melville, which I'm really excited about. Then obviously moving into neo-noir and into the present day, because a lot of these conventions still exist. But before we absolutely put a pin in it, is there anything else that you want to throw out? Any other titles that are just like you've been wanting to throw out that just hasn't been a place to until now?
The Killers.
The Killers.
Criss Cross.
Okay, why The Killers? Why Criss Cross? And then we're going to wrap.
Hemingway, because The Killers, and the story is something that would never be made into a movie, and it's been made three times. It's, as far as I'm concerned, an essential noir.
Okay.
Three different directors, three different time periods. It's a great, great
story. Actually, I want to say that Criterion recently released two versions together, right?
Right. The absolutely. The one with John Cassavetes and the original with Burt Lancaster. It's phenomenal. So Killers.
Carrie, Criss Cross.
Also, I got to say, Burt Lancaster, Yvonne DiCarlo, Bunker Hill, gritty, down and dirty Los Angeles at its finest. Criss Cross.
Amazing film.
Okay, so guys, as always, check this stuff out. A lot of these movies are
available. They're all available.
Oh, yeah, all available.
Every one of them.
If you can't find them on Netflix or Hulu, I guarantee you can go online to Amazon and you can get these DVDs pretty inexpensively.
On Crackle and other things like that, there's noir channels that have all of these films, including others that Carrie's talking about that are lesser seen. I mean, it's a potpourri. You've got everything.
Yeah, guys, so go check it out. Thank you for joining us this week. We are going to come back for our next episode, and we're going to talk a lot more film noir. In the meantime, guys, Byron, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at Byron Lee.
Yeah, that's correct, I think.
I think that one's it.
That's it. Carrie, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at Film Radar.
At Film Radar. Okay, and I am on all the interwebby, netty, talky things at The Lex Michael. Please like us, subscribe us, rate us 5 stars, tell us how much you love us, because we love you guys so very, very much. Thank you for tuning in. We will see you next time on Historic Hollywood.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.